You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today, probing the origin of life through assembly theory.
You know, life doesn't violate any known laws of physics, but it's not explained by them either. And so when you get to the origins of life, we're trying to explain living phenomena or why certain things exist on this planet and the sort of complexity that have been generated becomes very hard.
With astrobiologist and physicist Sarah Imari Walker.
And this is really coming from my collaborator Lee Cronin's lab, because he does these experiments where, you know, he's trying to evolve original life from scratch in the laboratory, and they wanted to have a measure of how would I know that the original life emerged in this chemical system.
And Retraction Watch's Ivan Aransky discusses the problems with peer review.
My experience at Retraction Watch tells me that the peer review system is basically broken. And by that, I don't mean that it doesn't have a purpose, or that it's not adding value, but it's adding much less value than I think a lot of people would like us to think. And it's been corrupted by bad actors and by an incentive structure for publish or perish that rewards mass quantity over quality.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. We're starting today's episode with one of the biggest mysteries in science, the origin of life. How do we find the underpinning of biological evolution in the laws of physics? Theoretical physicist and astrobiologist Sarah Imari Walker of Arizona State University has been working on a framework known as assembly theory with her colleagues. Assembly theory aims to quantify the complexity of molecules and objects by assessing the minimal number of steps required to assemble them from fundamental building blocks. Walker spoke to reporter Logan Chipkin about how assembly theory quantifies signatures of life in a way that could be used in space missions to search for extraterrestrial intelligence. She begins by outlining the central question that assembly theory aims to answer.
I think foundationally for me, it's about what life is. So trying to really get to whether we are missing some deep explanation that can account for many of the sort of odd features we associate to life. So there's always been this interesting feature that the laws of physics, you know, life doesn't violate any known laws of physics, but it's not explained by them either. And so when you get to the origins of life, we're trying to explain living phenomena or why certain things exist on this planet and the sort of complexity that have been generated becomes very hard to do with standard physics. And so I've just been really interested in what other kind of principles might be at play. And so one of the things we're trying to do with assembly theory is basically explore that space.
But how does assembly theory go about addressing why life is possible given the laws of nature? And as you say, the presence of life doesn't seem to violate the laws of physics.
Right. So I probably should start with where we start with biosignatures. So in assembly theory, because one of the biggest problems is how would you recognize that some feature, any feature, you might go out and observe in the world was created by a living process, or you might even say had signatures of design in it, right? So we don't think that the laws of physics contain design. And many of us that are looking for physical explanation for life don't want to necessarily invoke laws that contain design. So evolution obviously is one process where we know we get things like biological bodies and things that seem very complex and seem like they might have been designed, but of course they're evolved, not designed. So there's been this kind of general problem about how would you actually be able to recognize something had to have been evolved and not necessarily could be produced spontaneously. And so that's actually one of the main inroads when we're talking about biosignature detection as sort of a generic signature of life, is just to look for that kind of complexity that you think could only be there through an evolutionary process. The way we formalize that in assembly theory is actually very simple, and I think gets to some of the key points about why the problem is so hard and why assembly theory is kind of a unique way of addressing some of those hard problems. And so the way that we approached it originally, and this is really coming from my collaborator Lee Cronin's lab, because he does these experiments where, you know, he's trying to evolve original life from scratch in the laboratory, and they wanted to have a measure of how would I know that the original life emerged in this chemical system. So he was thinking at the level of molecules, how would I know that it was a product of a living system or not? So the way that it became conceptualized is if you think of a molecule, so you have some molecule in mind, you know, it's a configuration of a certain number of bonds and things, you can break that molecule apart in terms of its actual structure, and then break it apart again and break it apart again and break it apart again until you get to basic elementary building blocks. And the way we treat those in assembly theory when we think about it in molecules is to talk about those as bonds. And then the interesting feature comes when you want to reassemble that molecule, there's a combinatorially large growing number of possible ways to assemble it, depending on how many pieces it has. So you can think about if I just want to combine those simple building blocks, I can do it by just combining them in pairs, and I can build up that molecule by all of these different pathways. And one of the features of it is that the number of pathways is increasing as the molecule complexity is increasing, but also the shortest path to assemble it is increasing in size. What Lee's lab did was go into the lab, as they do, and actually take samples from biology and from dead samples and abiotic samples, and even some samples that were blinded provided by NASA. So they didn't know if they were sampled from living things or not. And they figured out a mechanism for, or a way to correlate this shortest path in the assembly space with the fragmentation pattern in a mass spec. So you can actually measure with a mass spec device in the lab the assembly of a molecule. And then they were able to demonstrate that the only samples that they had that had produced molecules with an assembly index above 15 were the biological samples. So it seems a sort of conjectured threshold where the exponentially growing space of possibilities is too large for the universe to explore randomly. And then it requires a directed information processing evolutionary process to create those specific things is about 15, at least on planet Earth.
It seems that you're groping towards, theoretically, what is the complexity threshold of a molecule, of an entity made of molecules, such that an information carrying medium would be required to produce such a molecule. Are you sort of thinking in that direction as you move forward with this research? Yeah.
Yes. So that's where the empirical work started. And what we're doing now is really trying to build that into using this idea of assembly, that molecules are these causal graphs, this way of all these joining operations for making them. And in fact, every object could be considered that way, from people to cars, to planes, to stars, to elementary objects. Could you build a theory of physics that actually accounts for what it is for selection to be operating in this huge space of possibilities and explain why we see the particular features that we do from a more fundamental physics perspective? But part of the challenge is the space that life exists in is super high dimensional. So you can look at life in terms of its physical motion. You can look at it in terms of its chemical complexity. You could look at it in terms of its morphological complexity. You could look at it in terms of language and information processing in this very abstract level. So part of what I see the program of assembly theory moving forward is to show that if you project life down into different kinds of assembly spaces, certain physical systems will look alive in some and not alive in others. And what I mean by that is you've got this high dimensional object of life moving through physical reality in some way. And it's really hard to see that entire structure. I think that's one of the reasons that we've had a hard time with understanding what life is to begin with.
Well, it definitely seems that the complexity angle is a very promising one. From what I've read, there was one more element that paired with the complexity in assembly theory when you were measuring the MA of molecules, right? It was abundance, yeah. Is that correct? Unlikely though it might be, some very complex molecule could appear and it could have a signature or whatever, but if we're interested in life, then almost by definition, life is propagating over many generations, in part because it's robust. Yeah.
I think there's this kind of notion that comes from quantum physics that things can just statistically fluctuate out of the vacuum, right? So we even have this idea of like Boltzmann brains, that like a brain can just spontaneously fluctuate into existence without an evolutionary process. And actually the current sort of theory is actually demonstrating this feature that because of these causal constraints in the assembly space, the fact that in order to assemble an object, you have to have a reliable process and there's this whole causal chain of events that constrains what can happen, you don't get things randomly statistically fluctuating into existence from just the space of possible things. They have to be causally connected to what came before. And so a simple example of that I can give is I would never expect a single human to ever exist anywhere in the universe, just one human being, right? We're a population. We're a distribution of very closely related things that exist that share a common causal history. And you can actually formalize and quantify that. So not any arbitrary history of stochastic fluctuations between things is possible, but it actually has to have this causal contingency.
I see. So then abundance and complexity in assembly theory aren't necessarily independent.
No, they're not. And the way I think about it fundamentally is actually to say that one thing that physics has been missing is we think about objects as existing in the three dimensions of space, but we don't actually think of them as having an extent in time. And assembly theory for me is saying that objects actually physically exist in time. They exist across time, and you need a certain amount of time to hold certain objects. So unless the universe had proceeded for a certain number of ordered events, you won't see certain structures emerge.
So I'm glad you brought time up. This is very interesting. Is it fair to say that, so you rank a bunch of chemicals based on the MA scale? Part of the theory is that basically molecules of a certain index require a certain amount of, let's say, cosmological time before they can evolve. So is it fair to say that you could look back in time through telescopes, and if you observed certain molecules with certain indices, would that render the theory problematic?
I guess my short answer is, in principle, yes, it could break the theory, and that could be a test against it. But I think exactly as you posed it, I don't think it could work. I think if I was going to take your idea and actually use it, I would say if I saw something like a Dyson sphere, like a technological object with very, very, very high assembly in the very earliest part of the universe, and it didn't, you know, there was no planet in its history or anything like that, then I think it might break assembly theory.
It just sounds like no, that it would be very difficult to render assembly theory problematic by just trying to find certain very complex molecules in the distant past.
I do want to emphasize that what we're doing with assembly is a falsifiable theory, right? So I think your more general question is, if we found a high assembly molecule under a situation that we would we could rule out the possibility of life being part of the explanation, then that would be something that could break the theory.
Have you presented this to scientists who are actively looking for signs of life elsewhere in the universe? Is assembly theory mature enough that you can present it to them and they can then apply it to data that they capture from?
Yes. Yeah. So absolutely. I don't think I'm really supposed to talk details, but I am speaking with some people working on mission proposals about the possibility of flying assembly theory and upcoming NASA missions. It is within the realm of possibilities. One of the issues is that the mass spec in Lee's lab is what's called an Orbitrap. And I by no means an expert in the experimental part or mass spec or anything, but it's one of the highest resolution mass spec instruments that you can get. And it's huge. And it's not possible to fly something at that resolution on a NASA mission. But I do have a student from my lab, John Malloy, that was in Glasgow for 6 months this year, working on the problem of what would be sort of the minimal resolution on a mass spec to be able to detect high assembly objects. And so we have made a lot of progress in that domain. So basically, the short answer is yes. It's not a conceptual limitation to be able to already fly assembly theory as the life detection proposal on a mission in the solar system that uses mass spec. But we do have some technical hurdles to get over to try to say with what confidence, based on the resolution of the mass spec, we've actually detected a high assembly molecule. It actually tends to be the case that most of the mass spec flown are only sensitive to measure low molecular weight molecules. And it might be that it's just too low to actually pick up high assembly molecules. So that's sort of where some of the debate about the detection issue is. So it might be that we have to suggest different instrumentation, but I don't think it'll be too far off from what's flown now.
Thank you to Sarah Imari-Walker for chatting to Logan Chipkin there. The fascinating conversation extended way beyond the edited version that you just heard. So head to our website, qspace.fqxi.org/podcast. That's qspace.fqxi.org/podcast to hear the extended version of that conversation. Walker is a fascinating speaker, and she went on to explain how life versus non-life may not be a binary categorization, but perhaps more of a continuum, and how that can complicate issues with understanding the origin of life. We have links to these and to more articles, podcast interviews, and conference talks with Walker on the QSpace podcast page. You can also find bonus material from other episodes of this podcast on the site that we don't always release through your podcatcher or on YouTube. I'm also going to add a link to FQXI's donation page. FQXI is a non-profit organisation, and these podcast episodes are only possible thanks to your support. And crucially, your donations also go towards funding research, such as Walker's, into foundational questions about life, consciousness, physics, and the nature of reality. Since her chat with Chipkin was recorded, Walker and colleagues have published more on the topic, and I'll be linking to their papers too, including a paper published last year in the journal Nature. That brings us neatly to the topic of scientific publishing in general. In our next interview, we hear from Ivan Oransky of Retraction Watch, which tracks and publicises retractions from journals with the aim of increasing integrity and transparency in the publishing process. Oransky is also involved with Archive, the physics preprint server, and one of a growing number of repositories where academics post their papers prior to peer review, so before they've been checked over by other experts in the field. So Oransky is ideally placed to discuss both the value and the problems with peer review today. Reporter Colin Stewart spoke to Oransky about his science and his journalism experience and how that has moulded his views.
Through his work with Retraction Watch, an organisation he co-founded, Ivan Oransky is shining a light on the murky world of papers that get pulled even after they've been peer-reviewed and published. As a journalist, he has strong views on the flaws of the current way that science is published too, but he didn't start out in journalism. I started our interview by asking him about the meandering path that led him there.
I grew up in a family of doctors. So you sort of went to medical school unless you didn't like the sight of blood, in which case you went to law school. You didn't necessarily become a journalist. I did end up going to medical school, but along the way, got very involved in the faculty beat at my college newspaper. I was immersed in tenure decisions and protests, frankly, and academic issues that are very much central to work that I do at Retraction Watch now. I used to sit in on peer review meetings. I learned a lot about how peer review worked and sometimes how it didn't work. So all of this was tilling the soil and planting seeds that I didn't even know I was going to end up doing anything with. So I left medicine to be a journalist full time. And then around 2008, 2009, Adam Marcus broke a big story about someone named Scott Rubin, who had made up all the patients in his clinical trials. Rubin ended up eventually going to federal prison for charges related to that misconduct. Adam did such a great job with the story, which I had never heard of until Adam broke it. It just got me thinking that there were all these great stories hiding in plain sight. And so I said to Adam one day, you know, and we've been talking about these issues, talking about different retractions. Rubin ended up having 25 retractions by the end of it. I said, what if we wrote regularly about this? What if we started a blog? And he said, sure, why not? And we did that, really not knowing what we were getting into. I mean, we knew the general contours of the stories. We understood some sources. We understood the landscape a bit, but we vastly underestimated how many retractions there were. And of course, that number has continued to climb ever since. So we're glad we did it. It's become really our life's work in many ways. But you know, would we have done it had we known how much work it would be? I like to think we would have. In fact, maybe that would have made us even more likely to do it. But at the same time, we honestly did not know just the scale and the scope of the story at the time.
What is it exactly that Retraction Watch does?
So when we launched Retraction Watch in 2010, Adam and I had really two goals. One was to tell stories that weren't being told. We thought that there were really interesting stories about scientific integrity, scientific misconduct, scientific publishing. And we noticed that there wasn't a lot of transparency about this process and that it wasn't working nearly as well as people would like us to think it does. Retractions themselves are very hard to find. When you go to a paper that's been retracted or you go to an index that collects papers and abstracts, you should find out that the paper's been retracted. And in fact, a lot of the time you wouldn't know that because of the way things really don't work. And so around 2014, we crystallized this idea and we've been keeping like spreadsheets of retractions because we couldn't keep up with them. And so we said, well, wait, actually, maybe the world needs an actual database of retractions. So we have the journalism side where we continue to report on these cases. We have the database side, which was acquired actually by Crossref in 2023, an acquisition that was terrific for many reasons. It gives us sustainability and it also makes the data open so anyone can use them. But we feel as though, you know, the journalism and the database together can provide a service to the scientific community and to the general public. And we feel as though that's been confirmed by the interest in what we do, the support for what we do. But we really do those two things.
What impact is Reaction Watch having?
The database means that we have a steady source of stories, a steady source of information and reliable information and statistics and all of that. The journalism generally informs the database in the sense that sometimes the journalism side finds out about retractions first and feeds into it. The journalism side can also prompt retraction. So when we are reporting on something and more people know this is a problem, sometimes that leads to action. A very concrete example of the way that this works is that someone did a study that found that when Retraction Watch, the blog, writes about a retraction, citations to that retracted paper after it's cited go down. And so that, I think, shows the power of doing both. In order to know about the retraction, you need to be in the database, and maybe you need some press coverage, maybe you need some publicity around it. I think that's how we look at our impact.
You've also been involved in the archive, a preprint server that publishes papers before they've been peer-reviewed. What was the thinking behind that, and what's your role there?
The idea was to get papers and findings and studies out to the community of people who could vet them and who could actually build on them much sooner than publishing necessarily would. At the Simons Foundation, which is where my day job is, running a publication called The Transmitter, I am involved in a gift that we provided to Cornell to not just support the archive, but to help them to modernize, do things like move to the cloud and, you know, build new functionality. And because here at the foundation, we think that the archive is a critical piece of scientific infrastructure, and that's why we're very happy to support it. So I serve as the program officer for that gift, as well as some other smaller projects here involving scientific publishing or, you know, open science and sort of issues like that.
What do you think of the current peer review system, and is it needed if we have preprint servers like Archive?
My experience at Retraction Watch tells me that the peer review system is basically broken. And by that, I don't mean that it doesn't have a purpose or that it's not adding value, but it's adding much less value than I think a lot of people would like us to think. And it's been corrupted by bad actors and by an incentive structure for publish or perish that rewards mass quantity over quality. There aren't enough resources to do it, even though peer reviewers are not paid, which is often surprising to people. But even just getting people to do it, the numbers of people, number of hours, I think that system is not just strained, but actually busted wide open in bad ways. One natural response to that would be, well, let's just publish less, let's do less science. I don't think that that's a good idea. And I don't think that that's really what the world needs. I think the world, frankly, needs more science. The world needs more knowledge and better understanding and getting closer to, you know, quote unquote, truth, right? I think the answer is actually to get more information out there and get more studies and findings and even conclusions out there, but be very honest about whether or not they're peer reviewed, which is where preprint servers come in. Preprint servers can make the entire process really reflect how science could and should work, as opposed to this only publishing really because you have to keep a job or a grant and ending up pushing more through the system than the system can actually handle. And you're starting to see some of that, which is great, but there's a lot of work to be done.
That was Ivan Oransky speaking with Colin Stewart. This interview forms part of a meta-science series examining scientific publishing and how to improve the doing of science in general. Over the coming weeks, we'll be posting more opinions from scientists, journal editors, and from academics who research meta-science, including more from Oransky. Keep checking qspace.fqxi.org for updates. On QSpace, you'll also find the winning entries and all submissions to our last meta-science-themed essay contest that asked how science could be different. And if you want to hear news of the next essay competition, just be a little bit patient, watch this space, or subscribe to our newsletter at QSpace, because there may be news coming soon. That's all we have time for today. Thank you again to Sarah Imari-Walker, Logan Chipkin, Ivan Oransky, and Colin Stewart. You can follow us on pretty much all the socials as either FQXI or FQXI Physics, and subscribe on your favourite podcatcher or on YouTube. Thank you for listening. I've been Zia Morali.